From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Bob Doty reporting. The massive collection of telephone data by the clandestine U.S. National Security Agency to thwart terrorist attacks has been halted in a Washington legislative standoff, but a reform version of the surveillance could be renewed in the coming days. The spy agency lost the legal authority to collect telephone records Sunday at midnight when the U.S. Senate failed to agree on an extension of several provisions put in place following the September 11, 2001 terror attacks. Earlier Sunday, Central Intelligence Director John Brennan urged the Senate to pass the new authorization, warning that terrorists were looking to take advantage of any gap in the spying effort. Islamic State militants drove a tank filled with explosives onto an Iraqi police base Monday, killing at least 37 people and injuring dozens more. Iraqi security officials had this information. The suicide bombing near Samarra, northwest of Baghdad and north of IS-held Ramadi, targeted security forces and triggered a secondary explosion in an ammunition depot on the base. Military and paramilitary forces are using the area as a launch point for anti-Islamic State operations. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter has pledged $18 million to help Vietnam buy American-made Coast Guard patrol boats to improve its maritime defense capabilities. Carter is in the communist state to boost military ties. As part of that effort, he and his Vietnamese counterpart signed a vision statement Monday to guide the expansion of bilateral cooperation. That includes the U.S. helping Vietnam to prepare for taking part in U.N. peacekeeping operations. This is VOA News. The severe heat wave gripping India is the second deadliest the country has experienced and the fifth deadliest in the world. Anjana Pashrisha reports from Mumbai that as the death toll across the country tops 2,000, there are rising calls for authorities to put in place more measures to cope with extreme temperatures.
Scattered rain brought relief to a handful of places from scorching temperatures that have persisted for nearly 2 weeks across much of India. But across vast swaths of the country, the heat showed no signs of letting up. A Brussels-based disaster center, the Emergency Events Database, called it the world's fifth deadliest heat wave. In the worst affected states, such as Andhra Pradesh, authorities issued advisories for people to stay in the shade. But it was advised many poor people, such as construction labor, hawkers and vendors, dependent on daily wages, could not afford to heed. The plight of those in crowded cities was worsened as a lack of tree cover and paved surfaces drove temperatures higher. In many places, temperatures have hovered around 45 degrees Celsius. Anjana Pusricha for VOA News, Mumbai.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry returns home Monday after breaking his leg in a bicycle accident. Kerry was hospitalized in the Swiss city of Geneva after the crash Sunday in France, about 40 kilometers from the Swiss border. State Department spokesman John Kirby said it was sensible for him to remain in the hospital for observation overnight for purely precautionary measures. Kerry, who fractured his femur, will receive further treatment in Boston. Kerry was in Switzerland for talks with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif on reaching a nuclear deal before the June 30 deadline. Bad weather is grounding a solar-powered Swiss airplane in the most difficult leg of its journey around the globe, powered only by the sun. The Solar Impulse 2 will land Monday in the Japanese city of Nagoya, delaying a landmark attempt by the solar plane to cross the Pacific Ocean. SI-2 is the brainchild of two Swiss scientists, Picard and André Boschberg. It took them 12 years to build the aircraft. SI-2 began its trans-Pacific journey Sunday, taking off from Nanjing in eastern China, headed for the U.S. island state of Hawaii, which was 8,500 kilometers away. Sunday's trip began after extended delays awaiting suitable weather conditions. I'm Bob Doty, reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Welcome to International Edition, where we take a closer look at stories of the day, social media, and entertainment. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, analysis of the political crisis in Libya. A U.S. telephone surveillance program expires. The possibility of teaching absolute pitch. Tips on protecting your mobile device from cyber spies.
You know, increasingly we spend a lot of our digital lives, so it's just more important than ever to learn some techniques about how to guard your mobile phone and your tablet.
And a rap song win stirs up controversy. It's all ahead, coming up right here on The Voice of America. The competing governments in Libya are under international pressure to end their political and military stalemate before the holy month of Ramadan, which begins June 17th. The government, that calls itself Libya Dawn, which holds Tripoli, rejected an initial United Nations proposal to end the conflict, calling it neither comprehensive nor balanced. The UN envoy to Libya is said to be ready with an updated proposal to be introduced this week. The internationally recognized Libyan parliament, which operates from Tobruk, is more favorable to the original UN draft, which recognizes them as the country's legitimate legislative authority for up to 2 years. Jason Pack, president of LibyaAnalysis.com, spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy about the possibility that the warring sides might be persuaded to cooperate in the face of the growing threat posed by Libyan radicals affiliated with the Islamic State.
Mr. Pack, how would the latest growing threat posed by radical Islamist groups in Libya, affiliated with the Islamic State, serve as a wake-up call for the warring factions to undertake a national reconciliation process?
Well, that's a good point. It should serve as a wake-up call, as should the flow of desperate migrants from and through Libya to Italy and Europe. Those are all symptoms. Both Islamic State and the migrant crisis are symptoms of the collapse of the Libyan state, of the failure of the political process. And the more that those things become obvious, the clearer that the underlying cause is a disaster. In other words, the Tobruk faction and the Tripoli faction don't govern the country. They don't even govern their local areas, and they must have a national reconciliation, or the situation will get far worse.
Following the flat-out rejection of the UN-proposed political agreement to end the Libyan conflict, what could be the possible conclusion of peace talks before the start of the holy month of Ramadan on June 17th?
I am not optimistic. I think that Bernardino León has not been given the power by the international community and by the powerful states to use enough sticks to get the compromises that are needed to make an agreement. He's a well-intentioned mediator, and everyone in the UN process is well-intentioned, but now they have this deadline, and there isn't enough time because the third draft of the potential agreement was rejected by the GNC or Tripoli side in April, and it doesn't seem like there are going to be enough substantive changes to get them to potentially sign. And then even if they would sign a new agreement before the deadline, how it will be enforced, whether peace monitoring European troops will come in on the ground, all of this is still up in the air, and the deadline is less than 3 weeks away.
But recently, a large pro-peace demonstration was held in Misrata, demanding a political deal with the internationally recognized government in Tobruk without caving in to Operation Dignity's requests. What could such pressure lead to?
Well, that is a positive development, and it represents a splintering of the Libya Dawn, or Western Libya, grouping. In other words, Misrata is splitting off from hardliners in Tripoli and Islamists elsewhere in, you know, Western Libya, Zawiya, other places. The majority of the Libyan people want a deal. They want to live in prosperity and benefit from their oil wealth, and they don't want this civil war to continue. But if Misrata breaks off and makes a separate deal with Tobruk and the HOR, it's not clear whether that will leave the rest of Libya. It may create a large number of hardliners in Tripoli and other Islamist strongholds who would sabotage the deal. I wouldn't consider a Misrata HOR deal as a true national reconciliation.
But failing to reach a political settlement between the two Libyan sides by the June deadline, what could be the other options?
All the options that will happen with a failed deal are much worse than any of the options that can happen with a deal. One that the Egyptians and some European actors are pushing for, Russia as well, is that we should just back the HOR as the legitimate government, and therefore use the failure of a deal to switch to a military solution or a political solution with one side only. I don't think that'll work, and that'll create great resentment inside Libya and make the civil war go on for years or maybe decades. So another option is to box the Libyans out of the international system, declaring all the factions to be unsovereign, maybe blockading the country, using a lot of sanctions, causing some pain there until the sides agree on a deal. And, you know, they have to suffer enough to want to make the compromises for a deal. I think that might actually be the right option between those two. And a third option, which is to me the worst actually, is the international community will turn its back on Libya and say, Libya's like Syria, it's a lost cause, just let them fight it out, doesn't matter, doesn't really affect us. That's a huge error, and it goes back to your first question, because then it will become a breeding ground for the Islamic State, the humanitarian crisis will be bad, the flow of migrants, and Libya should be a generator of wealth for the Mediterranean region, not an exporter of arms and an exporter of instability. So either of the first two options would be better, and I hope that we would choose the right plan B to push the groups back to plan A, i.e. making a peace deal.
Jason Peck, president of LibyaAnalyst.com, thank you very much for being with the Voice of America.
My pleasure.
You're tuned to VOA.
This is Science in a Minute. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Among the talents most desired by musicians is the ability of absolute pitch. Absolute or perfect pitch has been described as a person's ability to accurately identify a musical note just by hearing it. It's thought that less than one person out of 10,000 people has this incredibly rare skill. It was also believed that absolute pitch could only be developed during a short period of time in early childhood and that it was impossible for adults to acquire this coveted skill. But recently, a team of psychologists from the University of Chicago said that they actually taught some adults to develop absolute pitch and maintain the skill for a number of months afterwards. The researchers also said, however, that they couldn't determine whether the ability of absolute pitch taught to their adult subjects is as good as the rare and true perfect pitch. And that's your science in a minute.
The U.S. Senate is considering what to do next. Now the U.S. National Security Agency has lost the legal authority to collect telephone records. That's something that was put in place after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. And correspondent Michael Bowman is following the action on Capitol Hill, and he joins us on the line. Hi, Michael.
Hello, Susan.
Hey, what are the options for these senators?
Well, this afternoon they are debating the USA Freedom Act, which would continue the bulk collection of telephone records, but with one very significant difference. Instead of having those records kept on government servers with the National Security Agency, they would be retained by U.S. private telecommunications corporations. So we're talking corporate servers instead of government servers, and the records would be maintained. However, there is an unavoidable gap in terms of the actual collection of these telephone records because the NSA program expired late Sunday, just at the stroke of midnight, and there is no program in place that Congress has passed to replace it.
Senator Rand Paul, who is running for president, led the opposition against the program, and the White House has offered their 2 cents about this whole thing. Is this political grandstanding, or are there really some serious issues here?
There are indeed some serious issues, and as to whether Rand Paul thinks he's grandstanding, I suppose I would leave that up to him. However, Rand Paul is a consistent libertarian Republican. He is very skeptical about the reach of the federal government into the private lives of American citizens. And I am sure that this is an issue that he would be highlighting and speaking out about regardless of whether or not he were running for president. But I suspect that the fact that he is running for president, he knows that there's a spotlight on him. And I suspect that it is something that that he is keeping in mind and very much something he wants to highlight to his supporters.
Well, thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you.
And joining me here in the studio is reporter Michael Lippin. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Hey, what is the latest on how web users are reacting to the expiration of the NSA program?
Well, on our website, we've had a couple of comments posted on our latest NSA article, which is headlined, U.S. Spy Agency Collection of Telephone Data Halted. Now, Thaw's Heart from here in the U.S. downplayed the impact of the NSA losing its ability to collect phone data, writing, "Unlimited phone surveillance expired, yet the sun has come up. No apocalypse." Another reader who goes by the name Solaris praised Edward Snowden, the former NSA contractor who leaked the documents that revealed the spy agency's phone data collection program in 2013. Solaris said, "There is no doubt that Edward Snowden is the hero of our time. The difference between this whistleblower and others of his kind is that he is defending human rights while not supporting any form of anarchy." Now, Snowden, who's living in exile in Russia, has plenty of critics in the U.S. too. In fact, he's still wanted here on criminal charges, including passing classified info to unauthorized parties. Susan?
Thank you, Michael, for that update. We're going to take a short break now.
In the headline news, the massive collection of telephone data by the clandestine U.S. National Security Agency to thwart terrorist attacks has been halted in a Washington legislative standoff, but a reform version of the surveillance could be renewed in the coming days. Islamic State militants drove a tank filled with explosives onto an Iraqi police base Monday, killing at least 37 people and injuring dozens more, Iraqi security officials said. The suicide bombing near Samarra triggered a secondary explosion in an ammunition depot on the base. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter has pledged $18 million to help Vietnam buy American-made Coast Guard patrol boats. The severe heat wave gripping India is the second deadliest the country has experienced and the fifth deadliest in the world. And U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry returns home Monday after breaking his leg in a bicycle accident. Kerry fractured his femur. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
Coming up on International Edition, cyber spies out to tap your phone, and an Iggy Azalea song stirs up trouble. Much has been written over the years about the necessity of computer users to be proactive if they want to guard their privacy and keep their machines clean of viruses. But as the use of mobile phones and other devices has skyrocketed, surveys show that users have often failed to transfer these precautions to the mobile digital environment, leaving millions vulnerable. Well, BOA cyber correspondent Doug Bernard is here, and he's got that look. Doug,
hi, Susan.
I think I hear another cyber scolding coming from you.
You know, every time I come in here, it feels like I'm hectoring you, you know, talking about web hygiene. But, you know, these things are obviously important. Running antivirus, keeping your programs updated, good passwords, that sort of thing. The problem is that people have failed to take those practices into the mobile environment where, you know, increasingly we spend a lot of our digital lives. So it's just more important than ever to learn some techniques about how to guard your mobile phone and your tablet.
So how do we do that?
Well, the first best place to start is with the device itself. So if you look at phones, the three most popular operating systems, Google Android, Apple's iOS, and the Microsoft Windows Phone, they all now offer encryption as default. Now, you don't have to encrypt your phone, but I would strongly recommend people consider encrypting their phone. Basically, what that means is you create some kind of passcode, and all the information in your phone, all your pictures, your contacts, all that stuff is encrypted. You put the passcode in, you can get it. But if somebody steals your phone and they don't have that passcode, they can't get it either. They can't get into it. It really is permanently locked. So it's a good first place to start, I think.
Well, you know, I'm kind of not really good with a computer. You know that.
I don't know that I would say it that way.
Is this going to be hard for somebody who's a dunce like me to do?
It's not hard, but I think the key thing is you can't have a very easy passcode like 123. That's meaningless. But also, it has to be a passcode that's not so complex that you can actually remember it. So somewhere in the middle there, you can find a middle ground, I think.
And you're going to tell me don't write it down.
Absolutely.
That's right.
Don't write it down. Well, you've been listening.
Yes, I have. Every time you tell me that. So is encrypting the phone enough?
No. Let's go the next space to actually how you connect in that mobile environment. Many people are familiar and use what's called Wi-Fi. You know, you're out at a shop or a mall or that kind of thing, and you open your phone, and it will appear on your phone. Oh, there are networks available. The you can use Wi-Fi, but you're strongly recommended not to use what are called free open networks. Very often, I think even McDonald's offers this now in my neighborhood. It's a free open network. Anybody with a mobile can just hop right on without a passcode. The problem is those systems are so incredibly insecure that anybody in that open network can, if you're on it, they can, it doesn't take much at all. They can pop into your phone, they can snoop around, they can delete files, they can put in malware. So if you're going to connect in a mobile environment, don't use that open free Wi-Fi unless it's absolutely necessary.
Are people not being more careful because they're lazy, or why aren't they not watching themselves?
I think they're being less careful because they're simply really not aware. You know, you pop onto a network, an open network, and you see how convenient it is. You can get directions, you can go to Yelp, do whatever you want. But what they're not seeing is how easy it is also for the bad guys to use those open networks to get into your phone or your tablet and, you know, create all kinds of havoc.
Well, I'm glad you're not a bad guy.
Not yet.
It would scare me with all your knowledge. Okay, thank you very much. That's VOA cyber correspondent Doug Bernard right here in our Washington studios. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Some rap fans didn't think Australian-born Iggy Azalea's song Fancy should have won the Billboard Award for Best Rap Song. Here's VOA's David Byrd.
First things first, I'm the realest. Drop this and let the whole world feel it.
Iggy Azalea's pop rap tune, Fancy, has gathered all kinds of awards. It's made her all kinds of money. But it's also gotten her in a little bit of controversy. There was a petition to have her Billboard award revoked. To find out why and to talk more about this, I'm joined by Shauna Renee. Shauna, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
This controversy. First of all, Iggy Azalea is an Australian who has emigrated to the United States.
Correct.
She had a very, very popular hit. Every time you turned on pop radio, you heard Fancy.
Mm-hmm.
She was given the Billboard Award this year, for that song. But apparently there was some controversy and there was actually a petition to revoke her award.
Yes. Well, she received the 2015 Billboard Music Award for Top Rap Song. And a group of fans, Nicki Minaj fans, signed or created a petition on change.org. And they argue that the song was released a month before the eligibility date. So in order for a song to be eligible for an award, the production company or whoever's hosting the award will say, well, from this date to this date, the song must have been released. Well, as it turns out, the song was released in enough time. It just hadn't hit the top 100 here in the United States in enough time. So technically, she was still eligible for the award. But there were over 20,000 signatures, people who thought that Nicki Minaj's Anaconda should have won the award.
Now, is this just sour grapes, or, you know, Billboard basically said, look, it's our award and we'll give it to who we want to, right?
Well, and exactly. And they said, more importantly, it followed the rules. It was released within the time that it should have been. But you cannot ignore the fact that any time Iggy Azalea comes up in the hip-hop or rap community, that there are some cultural and racial undertones. So sour grapes, perhaps, on the part of Nicki Minaj fans who thought that Nicki specifically should have received the award. But there's been a lot of talk about whether or not Iggy Azalea is authentically hip-hop or authentically rap, whether or not she deserves a rap award versus, let's say, a pop award.
This is kind of a controversy that's been brewing for a while, though, because there's been a lot of pop rap songs, but they're not necessarily hip-hop songs, right?
Well, yeah, and it's kind of interesting and difficult to determine what is what. But there's been a lot of discussion, not only about the way a song sounds, but who's actually producing it. We saw this very same controversy sort of rear its head around the Grammys a couple of years ago when Macklemore and Ryan ended up winning a ton of hip-hop or rap awards. And there were questions about whether or not they are actually rap. They represent the genre. And you have to remember, here in the States, when you talk about rap, it's not just the music, it's the culture that goes along with it. And that's where people are a little unsure.
All right, that's Shauna Renee. And if you would like to learn more about this, log on to our website. That's www.voanews.com. You can also catch Shauna in the Soul Lounge. She's on that same website, voanews.com. Shauna, thank you.
Thank you so much.
If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Yet another Bangladeshi blogger has been hacked to death, the third such murder since February. Onanta Bijoy Dash was killed on May 12th as he left his home on his way to work at a bank. Four masked men attacked him, hacking him to death with cleavers and machetes, according to Sylhet police. Dash's death comes on the heels of the March murder of Vashikur Rahman and the February slaying of Bangladesh-born American blogger Avijit Roy. Mr. Rahman was hacked to death by two men with knives and meat cleavers just outside his house in the capital of Dhaka. Mr. Roy was similarly killed with machetes and knives as he walked back from a book fair in Dhaka. Dash was an atheist who contributed to Mukat Mona, or Free Thinkers, the blog founded by Mr. Roy. Bloggers on the site tend to be critical of Islamic fundamentalism, and many champion reason and science. In the last 2 years in Bangladesh, several bloggers have died, either murdered or died under mysterious circumstances. In 2014, Reporters Without Borders reported that a group known as Defenders of Islam in Bangladesh had published a hit list of writers it saw as opposing Islam. Nine on the list of 84 have already been killed, and many others have been attacked. According to Human Rights Watch Asia Director Brad Adams, this pattern of vicious attacks on secular and atheist writers not only silences the victims, but also sends a chilling message to all in Bangladesh who espouse independent views on religious issues. The United States condemns these attacks in the strongest terms. These are acts of cowardice. Real ideas do not require violence to defend them. We stand with the people of Bangladesh as they strive to protect the country's proud tradition of free thought and discussion.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.